Thank you very much. Well, I'm incredibly moved and flattered, first of all, to have been invited here in the first place, second, to see all of you here tonight. You could be doing much more exciting things, I'm sure, than attending a lecture. And then, lastly, to the Chancellor and Professor Sayyad for their really superb introductions. Far too generous and flattering. My topic tonight is Palestine and the universality of human rights. This is a very fraught moment to be speaking about human rights in the Middle East, and those of the Palestinian people in particular. But it does seem to be a symbolically useful time for the purposes of my lecture. The United States has already sent a hugely intimidating military force to various Arab and non-Arab countries in the region surrounding Iraq. The frankly imperial idea behind that is to disarm Iraq forcibly and also to change its dreadful regime. The rest of the international community, not least most of the Arab countries of the region, as well as some of the other permanent members of the Security Council, has been expressing varying degrees of disquiet and occasionally urgent disapproval. Although it is also clear that most governments in the Arab world are too unpopular and intimidated to do anything but to go along. Certainly, it's the case that no one outside of Iraq has suggested any iota of concern about Saddam Hussein and his government. It is the people of Iraq who stand to suffer the most and whose doubly and triply miserable fate is of the deepest interest to people all over the world. I'm sorry to say that none of this has had the slightest effect on what is a granitic will on the part of a tiny number of members of George Bush's administration to go forward with plans for a war among whose stated imperial intentions is the unilateral wish to bring American-style democracy to Iraq and the Arab world, redrawing maps, overturning governments and states and modes of life on a fantastically wide scale in the process. That all this has very little to do with the enhancements of human rights in a part of the world especially rife with their abuse is patently obvious. Were Iraq to have been the world's largest exporter of oranges or apples, there would have been no concern over its purported possessions of weapons of mass destruction or its extraordinarily cruel and tyrannical regime. This is a war planned for resources and for strategic control. And whether or not it occurs, the U.S. has at very least asserted its strategic dominance over the center of the world's largest known energy reserves from the Gulf to the Caspian Sea, and plans to reshape the area by pacifying threats to its dominance in countries like Syria, Iran, and some of the Gulf Emirates. To threaten war with such belligerence and such a wasteful deployment of military resources is an abuse of human tolerance and human values. That it might in the end turn out to be only a display rather than an actual use of force only deepens anxiety about the kind of world we are moving toward. Note also that by the end of the decade, China will be importing as much oil as the U.S., and by 2025, the United States will need to import a full 75% of its oil needs from the Gulf region, principally. As against those mighty facts, whether people are prevented from getting an education or from being allowed to move, express themselves, and organize freely without fear, either of intimidation, collective punishment, or straight-out assassination may seem, therefore, like relatively humdrum, if not trivial, issues. But they do pertain with a frightening parallelism to both the people of Palestine and the people of Iraq. In both cases, my point here is to assert the universal applicability of human rights to those unfortunate people, given that since World War II, there has grown up an impressive, even formidable, worldwide consensus that each individual or collectivity, no matter his or her color, ethnicity, religion, or culture, is to be protected from such horrific practices as starvation, torture, forced transfer of population, discrimination on the basis of religion or ethnos, humiliation, extrajudicial political assassinations, land expropriations, and all manner of similar cruel and unusual punishment. I want to affirm also that no power, no matter how special or how developed or how strong or how urgent its claims of past victimization, is exempt from accusation and judgment if that government practices such things. And finally, no people or individuals can be singled out as exceptions to these general rules so as to be considered, in fact, liable for such abrogations of human rights as those I've mentioned. Once big powers start to dream of regime change, a process already begun by the Pearls and Wolfowitzes of this country, there's simply no end in sight. Isn't it outrageous that people of such a dubious caliber actually go on blathering about bringing democracy, modernization, and liberalization to the Middle East? Heaven knows that the area needs it, as so many Arab and Muslim intellectuals and ordinary people have said over and over. But who appointed these characters as agents of progress anyway? And what entitles them to pontificate in so shameless a way when there are already so many injustices and abuses in our own country to be remedied? It's particularly galling that Pearl, about as unqualified a person as it is imaginable to be on any subject except, I'm told, souffles, and any subject touching on democracy and justice should have been an election advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme right-wing government during the 1996-99 period, in which he counseled the right-wing Israeli to scrap any and all peace attempts to annex the West Bank and Gaza and try to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible. This man and his colleagues now talk about bringing democracy to the Middle East and does so without provoking the slightest objection from any of the media pundits who politely, if not abjectly, quiz him on national television. Colin Powell's speech at the UN, despite its many weaknesses, its plagiarized and manufactured evidence, its confected audio tapes, which to anybody who knows Arabic are completely senseless, as well as its doctored pictures, was correct in one thing. Saddam Hussein's regime has violated numerous human rights and UN resolutions. There could be no arguing about that, and no excuses. But what is so tremendously hypocritical about the official U.S. position in the U.S. is that literally everything Powell has accused the Iraqi Baathis of has been the stock and trade of every Israeli government since 1948. And at no time more flagrantly since the occupation of 1967. Torture, illegal detention, assassination, assaults against civilians with missiles, helicopters and jet fighters, the annexation of territory, the transportation of civilians from one place to another for the purpose of imprisonment, mass killing, as in Qana, Jenin, Sabra and Shatila, to mention only the most obvious, the denial of rights to free passage and unimpeded civilian movement, education, medical aid, the use of civilians for human shields, humiliation, punishment of families, house demolitions on a mass scale, destruction of agricultural land, expropriation of water, illegal settlement, economic pauperization, attacks on hospitals, medical workers and ambulances, the killing of UN personnel, to name only the most outrageous abuses. All these, it should be noted with emphasis, have been carried on with the total, unconditional support of the United States, which has not only supplied Israel with the weapons for such practices and every kind of military and intelligence aid, but has also given Israel upwards of $135 billion in economic aid on a scale that beggars the relative amount per capita spent by our government on its own citizens. This is an unconscionable record to hold against the U.S. and the Secretary of State as its human symbol in particular. As the person in charge of U.S. foreign policy, it's his specific responsibility to uphold the laws of this country and to make sure that the enforcement of human rights and the promotion of freedom is applied uniformly without exception or condition. How he and his co-workers can stand up before the world and righteously sermonize against Iraq while at the same time completely ignoring the ongoing American partnership in human rights abuses with Israel defies credibility. And yet no one in all the justified critiques of the U.S. position that have appeared since Powell made his great U.N. speech has focused on this point. And that is what I want to do this evening. History is made by men and women. Excuse me. And the world we live in is a secular and historical world as a result. History is therefore the product of human labor, choice, and will. Nothing transcendental or divine can supersede that truth or suspend the consequences that flow from its application. There simply is no convincing way to assert special claims whose origin is the divine, claims that supposedly legitimate high altitude or smart bombing or the use of 60-ton bulldozers to demolish the houses of poor and defenseless people who don't happen to belong to the right religion or race. Just as I feel as an American that the United States has not been divinely endowed with a special errand into the wilderness and that its practices are endorsed by God, I feel it's my moral and intellectual duty to oppose the unjust use of its immense military, economic, and political power abroad for what is it claims falsely to be its national security interests. I have no power, so I must resort to the tools of education, to writing and speaking. By the same token, I want to reiterate my conviction here that the specific case of the denial of the human rights of the Palestinian people by the State of Israel cannot at all be justified on any of the grounds routinely accepted by far too many individuals and governments who would be the first to object to similar behavior in other cases. So far from Israel and the Palestinians being a special case of unusual circumstances, I think the exact opposite is true, that because Palestine is perhaps of all places on earth the one most densely saturated with cultural and religious significance, precisely that reality makes it an instance of universality thwarted and flouted. The universality of human coexistence, human acceptance of the other, and the human construction of a just and fair society for all, and certainly not only some of its residents. The point is that no state at all, has, in my opinion, is entitled legitimately to object to these formulations, and certainly no leader can state unarguably, for example, as George Bush has, that, I'm sorry, I'm kind of confused with where I'm going and where I'm coming here, and I'm, as George Bush has, that the United States is good and its enemies evil, or as General Sharon has announced, and I quote, "We are placing no restrictions on our operations in the Palestinian territories. Israel is under no pressure. No one is criticizing us or has the right to do so." I would submit that such sweeping statements of higher purpose and extraordinary impunity must be opposed and intellectually dismantled for the thuggish balderdash that such pronouncements really are, especially if they're intended to cover or explain or excuse or somehow justify barbaric devastation and vast ruin. Yet the contrast between the immensely powerful and the relatively powerful is not powerless, is not so simple, since the great outcry all over the world against unilateral U.S. war and the felt need by even U.S. government spokespeople to reiterate a general American commitment to democracy and human rights does in fact reveal a profoundly worldly awareness that aside from comfort and convenience, human beings today expect, rightly, to be respected, their requirements for a decent life met, their wish recognized not to be tortured or to be detained unlawfully, their concern for their children and their livelihoods accepted despite the supposedly higher priorities asserted by great power. All these, in theory at least, are rarely challenged head-on and considered to be human entitlements, even if such terrible abstractions as the national interest and national unity are affirmed as superseding individual rights. This unattractive and unacceptable argument certainly now prevails in the U.S., where education and history, for example, has become a profoundly ideological battle between proponents of a kind of primitive, heroic, white American nationalism and the much more sensible advocates of the multicultural, multiracial reality.
This other American history includes a bitter legacy of domestic slavery, imperial conquest, and terrible class inequality. So the universally accepted widespread conviction that everyone on earth deserves a modicum of human rights has only a symbolic moral power, perhaps too ill-endowed to take on so redoubtable a force as American global reach and all its all too numerous local henchmen and fearsome neoconservative spokespeople who want so-called American values to rule the world, resistance and objections notwithstanding. To speak about Palestinian rights in so skewed
a context, therefore, may seem quixotic. And certainly the current impression that Israel and the U.S. have borne all before them in their stubbornly ingrained hostility to Palestinian self-determination reinforces the superficial impression. But I want to argue that is not at all there is to the whole truth. There are other accomplishments and realities also to be noted with positive approbation and admiration. During my own lifetime, Palestinians, since the climactic events of 1948, when their society was destroyed and the establishment of Israel occurred, Palestinians have gone from the status of non-persons to that of a universally acknowledged national collectivity, i.e., a people, by virtue not of force of arms, but of other means, some of which I want to rehearse here. If for now Palestinians are still stateless, dispossessed, and for the most part exiled, it is because by those very unmilitary means, some of which are the mobilized force of memory, the power of images, and the heroism and ingenuity of sheer persistence, Palestinians embody perhaps the most visible and certainly the most universal case of human rights abuses on earth today. There's no desire on my part to be fetishistically competitive about such a claim, so I won't go on about it any further. But I do want to be able to talk about the visibility not only of the Palestinian presence as victims of injustice and human rights denial, but of the equal force they represent on the world stage of a wrong that must be righted. In an extremely suggestive lecture that appeared in 1995, the Welsh political scientist Ken Booth draws attention to the existence of a growing number of what he calls transcultural moral and political solidarities that have acted the part of what he calls sovereignty-free agents, that is to say, actors and institutions not bound by the borders between countries that set the international system since the Peace of Westphalia. That focus seems to me an excellent way of characterizing the overall human achievement of the Palestinian people in the period after 1948 until the present. Note that in all the many different places, conditions, and politics that the approximately 7.5 million Palestinians now live in, as citizens of Israel, as people under military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, as refugees and stateless persons in several Arab countries, as refugees with various acquired nationalities scattered all over the world, and as members of a dispossessed people, Palestinians have developed a moral and political solidarity with each other, nothing less, in fact, than a national identity, that it has been the goal of Israel to deny, obliterate, and refuse to acknowledge as sovereign. To argue backwards for a moment, let me cite only one recent example of what I mean by denial and a refusal to acknowledge. It was precisely that refusal that flawed the Oslo process from the moment it was undertaken in 1993, alas, with unqualified and unprepared Palestinian representatives delegated to a task which was designed not to restore but to further postpone and deflect the fulfillment of Palestinian aspirations. In this, neither Israel nor the United States was moved by an acknowledgement of past injustices, nor by a spirit of contrition or of reconciliation. With their batteries of legal experts backed by disproportional military weight in both countries, and at the same time as more than double the pre-existing number of settlements were being created on Palestinian land and more human rights abused, Israel and the United States divided and subdivided occupied and ever-diminishing bits of Palestinian territory into smaller and less viable units for the unfortunate Palestinian Authority to take over and misrule, all under the misleading, not to say willfully deceptive, rubric of the peace process. Was there any other intention at any time? I don't think so. It wasn't peace that they wanted, but pacification for a time. The Oslo Accords were far too much of a whole with several prior decades of Palestinian dispossession, house demolitions, land expropriations, and attacks on civil society. As against that, as I said a moment ago, there's been a moral and political solidarity building up between Palestinians all over the world. Some of it was evident in the past week's worldwide protests. One of its manifestations, and perhaps not its most significant one, is that today, for example, there is a Palestinian cinema, and with it a kind of transnational visibility of the Palestinian person that would have been unthinkable three decades ago. Visual symbols have played an extraordinary role in this reappearance of the Palestinian individual after years of absence and programmed national effacement. I don't want to rehearse here the steps taken by Israel inside former Palestine to systematically obliterate the centuries-old Arab presence along with its symbols and structures. I've described some of these on the juridical level so far as the taking over of land and property was concerned in my book, The Question of Palestine. But the overall plan, beginning in 1948, was to start Israel as if afresh, a state arising from nothing to take its place among the nations. In the affirmation of its renewed millennial identity, Israel managed for quite a while to remove the traces of Palestinian life for the most part, even though, of course, a large number of these traces, who remained as a remnant of people despite the expulsions of 1948, were there as a humbled and scarcely perceptible presence, ruled by military government inside Israel until 1966. Even so apparently simple innocent a discipline as our archaeology thereafter was complicit in the making over of the land and its markers as if there had never been any Arab Palestinians there. This is chillingly described by Nadia Abulhaj in her recent book, Facts on the Ground, Archaeological Practice and Territorial Self-Fashioning in Israeli Society. Her argument is that in the process of providing Israel with an ancient, objectivized history visible in archaeological evidence, the traces of other, more historically adjunct histories were ignored or simply moved away. What remained became evidence, she says, of a kind of essential Israeliteness, giving the state a pedigree in a long-distance past, with the intervening cultures and peoples pushed aside. Moreover, in a trilogy of powerful books entitled A Land Without People, the expulsion of the Palestinians, and the third one, the imperial Israel and the Palestinians, the politics of expansion in 1967 to 2000. The Palestinian-Israeli scholar Noor Masalha has unearthed both the practice and theory of emptying the land of Israel and of its indigenous inhabitants. Much of the pre-state Zionist ideology that mobilized Eastern European communities for the trek to mandatory Palestine was premised on the virtual absence of inhabitants, on what was often depicted as either a completely empty or a hopelessly arid land awaiting redemption. Later, or in some cases simultaneously with that contention, when the discovery of actual Palestinians could no longer be deferred or denied, there was a concerted effort to devise ways of spiriting them away, for which the war of 1948 provided field commanders and David Ben-Gurion himself with a rich opportunity. These are amply attested to in the Israeli military archive, as combed assiduously by a number of Jewish as well as numerous Arab researchers, including Masalha himself. Since 1967, the desire to efface or repress what has remained of an institutionalized Palestinian life in the cities and villages of the West Bank and Gaza has remained an often explicitly stated Israeli goal, recently hidden inside the polemics of a war for Israel's survival and a defense against extremist terrorism. But whether its new Jewish citizens liked it or not, Israel was always encumbered by Palestinian memory, which is one of my themes here. It's not as if a whole existence of a people can be easily wiped away like a footprint in the sand. The sheer banality of such a possibility is too obvious to require more comment here. What I would like to note, however, is that as the resourceful Palestinian-Israeli sociologist Ahmed Saadi has shown in a brilliant piece of historical and social synthesis, the more Israel has unilaterally exerted its considerable force to bury the Palestinian past, as it were, there has been a painstaking collective and yet uncoordinated Palestinian memory that has maintained Palestinian history since the Nakba of 1948 as a tremendously potent site of memory. Cinema is one result. What has remained of the vastly dispersed and disjunctive fragments of history since 1948 have been painstakingly collected over time by individuals as objects of memory, such objects as house keys, title deeds, photographs, letters, newspaper clippings, embroideries, and so forth. And through film, fiction, poetry, oral discourse, critical and political analysis, significant or traumatic collective experiences like the Deir Yassin, Kfar Qasim, Sabra and Shatila, and Jenin events, the significant episodes of Palestinian suffering have been preserved along with a national life that bore and outlived them. I remember writing in 1982 that whenever one of us had an opportunity to speak publicly, there was a felt requirement to start narrating the national collective narrative as if from scratch. No freestanding Palestinian story was available that could place before the world the chronological sequence of dispossession and catastrophic loss that has so disfigured and mutilated contemporary Palestinian life. Such a sequence has been interdicted in all sorts of ways, far too many times, by such things as the carting off by Israeli soldiers of Palestinian archives in Beirut during the 1982 invasion. And only the other day, the Israeli occupation army similarly removed records, computers, hard drives, statistics from Palestinian offices at the Central Bureau of Statistics, the Ministry of Education, and elsewhere in the West Bank. Whether this was meant to put a stop to Palestinian national life just short of full ethnic cleansing, I don't want to speculate here, but that such procedures are of a piece with claims that Israel is fighting for its life and that in occupying and destroying everything possible by tanks, bulldozers, F-16s, and Apache helicopters, it is defending itself against terrorists who happen to have no army or viable means of defense or means of waging war of any description, that seems totally obvious. In any event, the great narrative of Palestinian life hasn't yet been achieved any more than the fulfillment of its logical national aspirations have been fulfilled, although it seems just as obvious that there is no regression, no flagging among Palestinians everywhere on that inexorable drive. Despite all this, a Palestinian nation in exile has emerged with an unmistakable outline and personality of its own. The vast network of institutions, groups, and collectivities scattered all over the world that sustains the continuity of Palestinian national life is an amazing thing. It has drawn not only on the mobilized energies of Palestinians everywhere, but also on the dazzlingly widespread commitment to them of their friends, allies, and comrades all over the world. The obstacles placed before the path of Palestinians on a daily, minute-by-minute basis cannot be overestimated, each of them a conscious, willful abuse of human rights collected from everywhere, literally, in the history of colonial brutality against indigenous people, but now protracted into several regimes, simultaneous regimes of oppression. Note, please, the utter inequality of power between stateless and dispersed Palestinians and the collection of Arab states who offend their humanity, who dehumanize them, but who nevertheless house them. In Lebanon, for example, 400,000 Palestinians are kept stateless, their medical needs largely unattended to, their ability to work, study, and reside as they please, all of them universally accorded human rights. These are scandalously curtailed by statutory laws designed expressly for that purpose. In Syria and Egypt, similar conditions apply, only with smaller numbers of Palestinians involved. In countries where Palestinians have been fortunate enough to acquire citizenship, there are invidious laws that discriminate against them as somehow different from the rest of the population. This is sadly true even in this country. In the practice, for example, of racial profiling or singling out Palestinians in universities and in lines at the airport. Inside Israel, non-Jewish Palestinians are underrepresented. They are juridically not allowed rights of immigration, land ownership, and buying. These rights are automatically accorded to the Jewish citizen of the state and indeed of Jewish people everywhere in the world. Since late 2001, extra pressure on the Palestinians as a community has been applied to them inside Israel, even though they represent over 20% of Israel's population. As for the West Bank and Gaza, Gaza in particular, the 35-year-old military occupation, now the longest and most brutally sustained in modern history, has taken a terrific toll in the human condition of the Palestinians on every level. In fact, short of genocide itself, I cannot think of a single one of their human rights as a people that has not been violated with a kind of refined viciousness designed to dehumanize, break their spirit, and humiliate them to a degree that is, even to someone who has been carefully but helplessly aware of this taking place, simply stupefying. What's made it worse is how much of this has been willfully shielded from witnessing eyes by propaganda about fighting for survival and against terrorism, claims that in any other instance would defy the credulity of the most gullible intelligence. The sheer inequality between the average Palestinian and the average Israeli is breathtaking. You will say something disapproving about those terrible suicide bombers, and I will agree. But how many Israelis have had to live through the demolition by bulldozing of entire villages, blocks of flats, shopping districts? How many Israelis have had to endure missile attacks by Apache helicopter or rockets from American-made F-16 fighters? How many Israelis have to be stripped and searched at 300 checkpoints on an hourly basis? During the first 3 weeks of the present intifada, 1 million bullets were fired by Israeli military personnel at Palestinian civilians. Neither Indians demonstrating against the British nor South African blacks fighting against apartheid faced anything like this, nor for that matter did they have to reckon with missiles, hundreds of tanks, helicopters, and F-16s and rocket attacks fired into civilian areas as well as refugee camps with no defenses or arms, whatever. Consider that on the internet for January the 23rd, one can read that 836 Muslim pilgrims to Mecca from Gaza were denied permission to leave, that the Catholic cardinal, who's a Palestinian, was detained at Tel Aviv Airport that some towns on the West Bank have already sustained 214 days of consecutive curfew, that 150 dunams of fertile agricultural land were razed in Gaza, that three people, two of them civilians, were killed and six homes demolished, that 62 shops in Nazlat Isa were flattened to the ground, and that literally thousands of people on that day, many of them pregnant women, sick and aged men and women, children trying to get to school, doctors hoping to reach their patients and their hospitals, professors and undergraduates desperate to get to their classes with three universities closed, and ordinary human beings shopping, looking for food or work, all these detained, every single one of them, by the endless number of checkpoints that punctuate the existence of Palestinians in the occupied territories. Two or three days ago, 12 Palestinians were killed as a result of an Israeli incursion into Gaza. Dozens more injured, tens of houses demolished. In varying degrees of severity and brutality, this sort of thing has been going on there every day for 35 years, as in the meantime, dozens and dozens of new settlements have been set up by on Palestinian land. And if you look on a daily basis at the newspaper accounts of what's taking place in Israel, the Israeli elections, the resignation of some minister and the introduction of another, you read down to the end of the column in papers like the New York Times and you find two or three Palestinians were killed, a pregnant woman was died at a checkpoint, a family was detained. There was one in the paper this morning of of a group of young women and their parents detained, the house raided at 2 in the morning, taken off to jail for detention and interrogation because they were suspected of terrorists. This takes place all the time. Conversely, how many Palestinian settlements have infringed on Israeli property? How many daily armed incursions, sometimes with 60 tanks at a time, have penetrated Israeli towns and villages? How many Israeli fields have been burned? With all the ritual and fuss surrounding the planting of trees in Israel, does anyone bother to recall that an average of 896 Palestinian trees per day have been uprooted by Israeli settlers and soldiers since the beginning of the Intifada in October 2000. For this kind of brutalizing assault, the United States and Israel designed a peace process that lasted 10 years, which was not even supposed to put a stop to all this, but rather to make it seem slightly less unbearable. Yes, a peace process requiring thousands of hours of negotiations to make Israel stop, which of course it didn't at all. You have to use your memory to keep in mind that since the current Intifada began, representations of all this have been available on the international media, they simply do not render anything like the harsh awfulness of what life is like for a Palestinian on a daily basis. Tim Llewellyn, a well-respected veteran BBC reporter, has recently shown that when one terrible suicide bombing in December took place, it was reported, he says, as if it were the beginning of a new cycle of violence, whereas the fact that 75 Palestinians had been killed in the preceding month, 14 of them children under the age of 18, went unmentioned, as did the fact of military occupation and resistance to it. Making the astonishing illegality and inhumanity of Israel's policy of Palestinian immiseration even more difficult to recall or even to see, not only for outsiders, so to speak, but even for Israelis themselves, is that, as Amira Haas writes in Haaretz, and I quote her here, a person could travel the length and breadth of the West Bank without ever knowing not only the names of the villages and cities whose lands were confiscated to build the Jewish settlements and neighborhood, but even the fact that they exist. Most of their names cannot be found on the road signs. A Jew traveling on the almost empty roads of the West Bank would think that there are no longer any Arabs. They do not travel on the wide roads used by Jews. End of quote. It's equally significant of the assault on memory and visible reality that the entire Gaza Strip, which contains 1.3 million Palestinians and a mere 7,000 Israeli settlers who control the water resources, as they do also on the west, on the other occupied territories, and are protected by thousands of Israeli soldiers, the whole of Gaza is surrounded by an electrified wire fence, making Gaza, as an Israeli journalist has noted, in effect, a gigantic prison. Both Barak and now Sharon have pressed ahead with a building of a fantastically expensive wall, which, quite apart from destroying more Arab land and separating towns from their farm acreage on a vast scale, is designed to blot out the existence of the Palestinians. All of this has gone on with the full support of the United States and its passive taxpayers. This tremendous assault on memory, to say nothing about current reality, is quite without precedent or analogy in our postmodern times. Not in former Yugoslavia, nor in Africa, nor elsewhere in Asia and Australia, with the kind of approbation that Israel has gotten. By contrast, however, I'd like to remark that all these efforts have not achieved their goal, because in every possible way, the diverse affirmation of Palestinian identity, far from being a negative or passive thing, has grown first and foremost a culture of human rights and democratic processes at the grassroots level that has included a sensitive register of the claims of memory, as well as a demand for attention and justice despite the world's indifference, and a healthy awareness of the ironies of unequal power. The other fact I'd like to note is that even though in the U.S. and parts of Europe the notion of Palestine is associated invidiously with terror and violence, there is, as I said earlier, a serious contradiction to that superficial association in an ongoing and recognized Palestinian national life with a quite peculiar, if not outright, eccentric tenacity to it that has simply overcome all the terrible ordeals placed in its past. There is today a Palestinian literature, a Palestinian legal, political, and scholarly discourse, a Palestinian cinema, a Palestinian theater, a Palestinian oral tradition, a large number of Palestinian grassroots organizations all over the world. In short, a Palestinian style that invigorates and informs all aspects of this far-flung community's existence. The main thing about it that I want to assert is that it is quite irreversible and is fully an organic part of the universal debates on human rights, injustice, and the narrative of human freedom. Moreover, it's situated in contemporary awareness in all sorts of interesting ways. The habit of considering everything about Palestinian as at bottom being anti-Israel does an extreme disservice to the richness of the achievement I've been discussing. As Rashid Khaldi has pointed out in his book, Palestine and the Palestinians, there was a coherent Palestinian national life well before the onset of Zionism at the end of the 19th century. And this has never been broken. Moreover, the universality of the drive for Palestinian self-determination has acquired an unbudgeable place in the world's agenda for liberation, sustainability, and resistance. Every major UN conference for the past two decades, whether concerning the place of women, the environment, racism, human rights, disarmament, health, human development, economic sustainability, has had an important place in it for the question of Palestine. Paradoxical though it may seem, the Davos meetings last month for governmental and corporate leaders had an important component of its agenda devoted to Palestine, while at the other end of the world, in Porto Alegre, in Brazil, the anti-globalization meetings featured the presence of a large Palestinian contingent whose presence assures an additional progressive dimension to the debates there. Any discussion of Middle East peace turns out inevitably to be mainly about the question of Palestine. If in the period after 1948, as part of the post-war reemergence of Europe, Israel had the status of a progressive cause, it is now Palestine that has taken that place. One need only think of the support Israel had from such people as Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir to gauge how far from that position it has today fallen. As some of its homegrown critics like Amos Ilon and Avishai Margalit have noted sadly, that since the first Intifada of 1987, Israel has been transformed dramatically into a symbol of oppression and injustice, lumped together with the United States for its imperial arrogance, its supremacist attitudes, and its inhumane policies towards the Palestinians over which it has ruled for so long. Divestment campaigns reminiscent of the anti-apartheid movement have become an important item on American campuses. Berkeley has a place of honor in this effort. And in Europe, numerous academics and intellectuals, artists and writers discuss boycotts of Israel that were unthinkable a mere 20 years ago. Problematic and humanly a very compelling issue, the challenge posed to conscience and consciousness by the Palestinian people raises a whole raft of questions about the post-Cold War political order that are quite unique in their density and difficulty. Contentious and noisy, though some of these may be, I want to bring this lecture to a close by looking at three of them as dispassionately as I can. I won't minimize the fact that I'm a partisan and that I believe that the cause of Palestine and Palestinian human rights is one of the great idealizing symbols of our time. But it's just as true that it's bristlingly complex nature is what makes it so. So there are three, at least three, very difficult, very thorny oppositions or syntheses that I want to look at now, not from the viewpoint of a policy expert offering solutions and pragmatic answers, but from the perspective I can bring, that of a humanist and intellectual who's been profoundly engaged in the matter, but who is independent, and I would like to think as free as it's practically possible to be of unshakable doctrinal or ideological hobbles. Take the matter of victimhood as a start. For a Palestinian like myself, who's had the most fortunate and the most luxurious of life compared with the overwhelming number of my refugee compatriots or those who've had to live under Israeli rule for decades, it's still difficult for me to minimize how much more Palestinians have been sinned against than as a whole they have sinned, how much they have suffered terribly in an unacknowledged silence even today. As of this moment, not a single major Israeli political or intellectual figure has articulated any serious contrition, to say nothing of accepting responsibility for the disastrous and sustained human suffering of the Palestinian people. I know nothing at all in contemporary history quite like this amazing stone wall of obduracy and denial. And yet, I must also say that the legacy of persecution, genocide, and anti-Semitism that is so much a part of Israel's history is a background to be figured in and contended with just the same. Two communities of sufferings, I've called them in the past, but one must, I think, make clear that at the present time, one community has a tremendous balance of power in its favor. The other is, so to speak, the victim of the former victim. Israeli policies, as well as the meditation of many Western liberals who feel a collective guilt for Christian and European anti-Semitism, nevertheless must be able to disentangle the past from the present, to make very clear distinctions between respecting the appalling past injustices heaped on Jews historically on the one hand, and on the other simply excusing what the state of the Jews has done to the entire Palestinian people ever since. There is simply no earthly or divine dispensation that would excuse a state or a people for wreaking havoc upon another while pleading through the travails of its own past as an excuse. My argument here is to say that such claims do not at all correspond with universalism or the idea that human rights cannot be manipulated to accommodate what is a record of patent brutality and cruelty in the past. Palestinians have been displaced. They have had their society shattered. They have had to live under military occupation. Their lands and lives are today systematically torn apart. There are no two ways about it, I believe, which is not to say that we must simply overlook the tragic history of the Jews. On the contrary, I would always want to say that as a Palestinian, I should make my case to defenders of Israel on the basis of taking full account of, making due acknowledgement of the history of discrimination against Jews. That kind of policy should never, ever be visited on anyone for any reason at all, least of all by Jews, in the name of their safety and independence. The second opposition is the one that sees the contest between Palestinians and Israelis as a contest of nationalisms, which at their most feverish and embattled fail the crucial test of awareness, the awareness of the other. Historically, Palestine is a palimpsest of an enormous number of peoples and civilizations, each of them serially leaving traces and effects that have lasted for several centuries. It must be said again and again that everything we know about ancient Palestine speaks to a rich multiplicity of peoples and tribes, not just of Israelites, but also of Canaanites, Philistines, Jebusites, Moabites, and many others. To extrapolate from that and say that only one people dominated and is therefore entitled to lay exclusive claim to Palestine today is simply a tragic misinterpretation and betrayal of something far richer and interesting. One can interpret that history, therefore, inclusively, giving rise to complexity and universalism, or far more narrowly, as the exclusive possession of only one people and culture who seem to prefer unending war against others to mutual recognition and coexistence. Civil wars are much more bitter and unyielding than any other kind. I think that's the essence of the problem we face today, namely whether, as some believe, Palestine ought to become and thereafter remain the homeland of just one dominant people, or whether it can become the homeland of the people who actually live there, regardless of race and religion, even though for the time being they are locked in mortal combat. I don't know the answer to that question, but it seems to me that there potentially lies the universality of the appeal for Palestinian human rights. Now a second-class, dispossessed, and downtrodden people, for the past century and a half, the Palestinians have been struggling for equality in that land, much as the non-white people of South Africa waged the battle for liberation and equality there. I don't think building a wall is going to solve the problem. Of course, there will be disagreements over how and what sort of equality in form and method must be achieved, but that it is the desired result is, as far as I'm concerned, the great truth of our undiminished energies as a people that has simply refused to go under and give up. The final point I'd like to mention is the antithesis between present antagonism, bitter present antagonism, and future reconciliation. Antagonism is the structure that today binds Palestinians with Israelis in the land and in the diaspora. Neither people has been blessed with a Mandela, nor even a de Klerk. We are very far from a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The number of visionaries who have articulated thoughts that go beyond a wretched, impoverished opposition is tiny, if they exist at all. Yet there have been Israelis and Palestinians who have tried together to work against injustice and intolerance, but they are a minority, a beleaguered, outnumbered minority with very limited influence now. But that need not always be so. And there are other models than that of civil war. Let me conclude on a modest personal note, not because I want to prophesy a brilliant future, but because circumstances sometimes create new things to see and new models to follow. About a decade ago, through a rather amusing coincidence, I met the great Israeli pianist and conductor Daniel Barenboim in the lobby of a London hotel where we both happened to be staying, he to give a concert with Pierre Boulez at the Barbican — I'd already bought a ticket for the event — I to record the Reith lectures for the BBC. We recognized each other We quickly befriended each other for temperamental reasons, of course, but also as an amateur pianist and musician, I had a great passion for the art and was fascinated by Daniel's ebullient gifts and personality. Music brought us together, but so, of course, did our common background in the Middle East. It turned out that he and his family arrived in Israel from Argentina in 1950, shortly after my extended family had completely left Palestine. Over time, and given our itinerant schedules, we developed a very warm, special friendship, one result of which is a book of conversations that has just been published and is called Parallels and Paradoxes, a phrase that goes some way to describe the way our interests in music, culture, politics, the piano, and life in general cross and crisscross, sometimes in harmony, sometimes with divergence and difference. It's important for me to say that our friendship has become tremendously important for me, and I dare say for him. He has now visited the encircled and occupied West Bank on his own several times. First time he went, I was with him in the early part of 1999, where he gave a recital at Beer Zeit University. This year, he went twice, donating his talents to a starved and deprived Palestinian public in Ramallah, where his easy naturalness of being has made him a great number of friends and admirers. No other Israeli or Jewish artist has done anything so generous or compassionate as Barenboim. In addition, he has taken under his wing two tremendously talented young Palestinian pianists, made himself available to them as teacher and mentor, as well as helping to arrange concerts and teachers for them. But the main story I want to tell concerns what we have called the Weimar Project, or the East-West Divan. In early 1999, shortly after Weimar, formerly in East Germany, had been designated European Cultural Capital for that year, I happened to be in Berlin visiting Barenboim when he was offered the chance to perform in Weimar that summer. After a short discussion between us and with Yo-Yo Ma, who also happened to be there, we decided to use the opportunity instead to do something different, namely, in facilities generously provided by Weimar and the federal government of Germany, we would first audition a whole set of young musicians aged 17 to 25, with one exception, a 10-year-old Palestinian piano prodigy who also happened to be my great-nephew, to audition a whole set of young musicians all across the Arab world and Israel. By the end of the auditions, we had the makings of several excellent chamber ensembles, as well as a fine orchestra made up of instrumentalists from seven or eight Arab countries and Israel. We convened in August of that year in Weimar, and for 3 weeks they were drilled and rehearsed and fashioned into a remarkably proficient orchestra by Barenboim, who devoted 6 or 7 hours a day to the task, as well as going back and forth 3 times a week to conduct Wagner operas at nearby Bayreuth. My role was to lead nightly discussions in which everyone participated in every subject from music to literature, history, and of course politics. In Weimar, we were not only generously taken care of by the cultural capital's auspices, but figuratively speaking, we were under the wing of Goethe, Weimar's most famous inhabitant, who had written there his great mature masterpiece, the Westöstlicher Divan, the West-East Divan, an extraordinary act of homage to Islam generally and to the Persian poet Hafiz in particular. Goethe was, I believe, the first great modern European to attempt some kind of artistic synthesis and involvement between what in those days were called the Orient and Europe. His accomplishment was the magnificent Divan itself, as well as, for our purposes, the use of art, so to speak, to create an imaginative reordering of polarities, differences, and oppositions on the basis not of politics, but of affinity, spiritual generosity, and aesthetic self-renewal. We also exposed our students to Buchenwald, one of the most notorious of the Nazi death camps, which lies only about 6 kilometers outside Weimar, thus serving us to point out how very close together the great heights of culture can easily coexist with the deepest and basest evil. The point of all this is that a new paradigm emerged for us and our students who were, it should go without saying, from differing and sometimes jarringly antagonistic backgrounds, and whose interests, ambitions, histories, and commitments during the 3 weeks were suspended, as it were, in the interests of music. Music, I don't need to insist on this too much, is a silent art. What and how it articulates in sound are totally independent of the world of ideas, concepts, and words themselves. Yet also dependent on them in that those very things suspended by music's enactments are paradoxically the very worldly circumstances that bring musicians together. But that opposition and symbiosis between music and the world, so to speak, proved amazingly fertile. We did another summer in Weimar the next year, 2000. In 2001, we went to Chicago. And last year, and for the next few years, including this one, our East-West Divan has been adopted by the Andalusian government, as well as a private foundation of 3 cultures. Seville has become our new home. From Weimar to Seville is, I deeply believe, a totally different trajectory and paradigm for Arabs and Israelis. There's no political program to what we do, since everything is subordinated to music, which for 3 weeks possesses everyone, in addition, of course, to the practical matter of living and working and talking together. The point of telling you this story is to suggest how, despite the incredibly polarized, antagonistic and discordant world in which we live, there's always the possibility of another alternative type of social model. Barenboim is no ordinary Israeli, of course, and I like to think perhaps I'm not an ordinary Palestinian either. But in our work and commitment to our friendship and to music making and to the ongoing Weimar-Seville project, there's been an amazing crossing of borders and a disruption of the rigid lines that have circumscribed and organized our public as well as private lives. If it weren't for the rich and emblematic status of Palestine and Israel, none of this would have been possible, since it is because the complex issue itself, whose core from my point of view is the struggle for Palestinian human rights in a land sanctified by the 3 great monotheistic religions, is so fertile with possibilities, ones that reach into culture, politics, history, and personal relations, that we've been able to do what we do. Presiding over our efforts, students and teachers alike, has been the spirit of music, which I would want to insist is neither a sentimental panacea nor a facile solution for every problem, but rather a practical utopia whose presence and practice in our riven world is sorely needed and in all sorts of ways intensely instructive. At least, therefore, another world emerges as a result against the backdrop of Andalusia, itself an alternative model for a coexistence between the 3 monotheisms. And if it isn't immediately available on the world stage, it can at least signal the arrival of a new attitude whose example might soon provide us with many others, many salutary changes, many profound new interpretations of what is now only an appallingly polarized, completely inhuman conflict. In our work and planning and discussions, our main principle is that separation between peoples, war between peoples, is not a solution for any of the problems that divide them. And certainly ignorance of the other provides no help whatever. Cooperation and coexistence of the kind that music, lived as we have lived, performed, shared, and loved it together, might be. I, for one, am full of optimism, despite the darkening sky and the seemingly hopeless situation for the time being that encloses us all. Thank you.